Commentary Track, conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Welcome to the Commentary Track. I'm Frank Thompson, your host, The Fiend Without a Face, and we have a really good one for you today. I think the first TV show I ever worked on was the worst TV show I ever worked on. In fact, I believe it was the worst TV show that anybody ever worked on in the history of television, and perhaps even in the prehistory of television. It's called Hollywood Babylon. My dear friend Tom Holland had wrested the rights from Kenneth Anger to do a TV version and then sold it to what I will just charitably and non-litigiously say were the wrong people, who just made a gargantuan mess of the thing. I was given the opportunity to write a script for one of the episodes of Hollywood Babylon, and I think I actually wrote two scripts. I'm a little fuzzy on it because I haven't seen any of these things in years. Actually, I've never seen any of them. They were horrible. Obviously, it was Hollywood Babylon, so it was a show about the seedy side of show business, and they wanted me to do one on George Reeves, the star of Superman, and the ongoing so-called controversy as to whether he committed suicide or whether he was murdered. As I was doing my research, because I approached this thing as a real film historian, it never... I tried my best to get the real facts into these things. As I was researching it, a name kept coming up, Jim Beaver, who had written a lot on George Reeves. And I realized that he'd lived here in town and out in the valley. And so I just looked him up in the phone book, gave him a call. He invited me out to his house in Van Nuys. And went out there and found him to be a delightful fellow who knew a whole lot about George Reeves because he was working on a biography of Reeves. And he had already written a book on John Garfield. And I found out that he was also an actor, although I, at that point, had not seen him in anything, or if I had, it just hadn't registered with me. But he was a terrific guy, and it was a delight to meet him. And so over the years, I would run into him again here and there, and sooner or later, we got to where we would hang out to a certain extent. I don't want to overstate that at all. It's not like we're Archie and Jughead, but we do have the occasional lunch, and when we do, we sit and talk movies. I thought Jim Beaver would be the perfect guest for the Commentary Track. He's worked in film and television for more than 20 years, but he's also a film historian and a fine author. So when I called and asked him to do it, he immediately said yes, and then it was, I would say, close to 8 months of my asking again and again, and he was always off in Canada shooting Supernatural, or he was doing a movie or something. He's a busy guy, and I'm not, so I'm the one who kept bugging him. But sooner or later, everything came together, and I went over to his house, and we just had one of the talks like we always have, except in this case, I had a recorder going, and that's the only difference. But he's a fascinating guy. He's also just one of the nicest guys you'll ever meet. And through TV series such as Deadwood, and now especially Supernatural, he's probably the most famous guy I know. It's really interesting to me because when I met him, he was not famous at all. Although, as I found out, he was already highly admired as an actor. But he wasn't exactly a household name. But with all the fans of Supernatural, and they go around the world, let me tell you, he is a household name in many, many, many households. So it's my real pleasure to introduce a conversation with my friend Jim Beaver. Tell me about George Reeves. How in the world did you get interested in that?
I guess my initial interest was, of course, being a baby boomer and growing up watching the Superman show in the 50s and 60s and being a fan, but and I was always sort of intrigued by the so-called mystery of his death. At the time, when I was a kid, it wasn't exactly a mystery. in the sense of who did it. It was a mystery in the sense of why would he do that and commit suicide, that is. And in the mid-70s, I started writing for Films and Review magazine, the magazine of the National Board of Review. And the magazine specialized in just film history and actors' biographies and things like that. And my editor there asked me if I wanted to do a piece on Reeves because they had gotten a number of requests from readers for something biographical on him. And I said, yeah, sure. That sounds fun. And I started researching, and it just seemed like a much bigger story than a mere article. And so 178 years later, I'm still working on it.
I'm assuming that you interviewed everybody who knew him or
worked
for them?
The background of the history of my work on this project, on one hand, it's kind of humiliating to be 30 plus years into writing a book. Little did I know when I started it that I was going to end up with my own acting career, which was going to kind of overwhelm my film history work. But one of the advantages of having started that long ago is that there were a lot of people still alive who knew Reeves, and I was able to get interviews with people that, to the best of my knowledge, no one else was able to get. So, in that sense, I'm glad I started when I did. I hate the fact that it's taken so long. I spent months and months in basement archives and libraries and newspaper morgues looking for stuff that I can find in 5 minutes on the internet now. I was able to get a lot of information in the early days that I would never be able to get now. And and yet I still keep my hand in. I'm very fortunate to be busy as an actor. I was only home 3 weeks the first 6 months of this year. So it's hard to concentrate on the book, but I still work on it, and I still managed to find out things that I didn't know. And there's still a few people left to interview. So it proceeds apace.
Well, at this point, do you look at it as a biography of Reeves or an investigation into...
It's definitely a biography. The circumstances of Reeves' death are interesting, and they're probably the draw for most people who would read such a book who aren't diehard Superman fans. And it certainly has to be dealt with. And I have my opinions. I've had different opinions over the years that have changed as I've gathered information and insight. But no, my intent was always to write a full-scale biography. And the circumstances of Reeves' death will be the latter part of that biography, but not all of it by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I never saw the episode of Hollywood Babylon that I wrote about Reeves, and I can only barely remember, but I'm pretty sure we probably came down on the most salacious side of it. So,
on Hollywood Babylon?
Yeah, I know that's shocking, but...
It was always sort of the New York Times of salacious exploitation television.
I do believe that history will show that it was the worst TV show ever produced, ever. I don't think anything even comes close.
I've acted on some of its competitors.
But you'd still come out on the plus side, believe you me. But around the same time, you published your book on John Garfield.
Yeah.
That was, what, 78?
It came out in 78, I believe. I wrote it while I was in college. I figured there had to be something more interesting than what I was studying, and I really thought it was going to be a matter of a couple of weeks' work and send this thing off to the first publisher that it occurred to me, and they would snap it up. And well, it took me a couple of years to write it, and a couple of more years for it to come out, but and by the time it did come out, I sold it to, what was the publisher, Barnes, A.S. Barnes. I sold it to them before there had ever been a book on Garfield, but it took them a relatively unusual 2 years of production to get it to market, by which time there were two or three books on Garfield out. So John Garfield wasn't, at that time, the mid-late 70s, he was in some danger of being forgotten. And at the same time, though, the publishing business was still pretty good about putting out books about older stars and the old days of movies, and you could still sell something like that. And I know it's a very, very different world now. My father-in-law was Don Adams from Get Smart. Three-time Emmy winner, huge, huge star, and even in his very late years was, you know, one of those people stopped on the street to, you know, talk to. And he wrote an autobiography, and we couldn't sell it because the publishing world said, well, he, you know, that show was 40 years ago. But you know, the Civil War was 140 years ago, and people seem to buy books about it. So, it's a very different world now. I was lucky to get my book published, and I look back on the book and I go, I was real lucky to get the book published because, I was a college kid, and there are certain naive things about that book that bug me a little bit now. But I did have the pleasure of having John Garfield's daughter tell me that it was her favorite book of the books she'd read about her father. So it kind of astonished me, but nonetheless, I guess it wasn't a total flop. I had a series called The Films Of, and it was, you know, a wide range of people: Boris Karloff and Cary Grant and Marilyn Monroe and Laurel and Hardy, Citadel was really good about putting those things out. Citadel passed on my book, but they, and it turns out it was because they did have a Garfield book in the works. And Barnes picked mine up, and the book is, you know, it's basically an examination of each of Garfield's films with a long biographical essay at the beginning, which is the basic format of pretty much all filmography books of that nature, and lots of photographs and examples of reviews, and I made a really sincere effort to get behind the star facade and find the real man that Garfield was. I don't know that I did, but I know that I got good responses from people who knew him. So I suspect I was close. That said, it's not a terribly in-depth piece. But none of those things really were. I dare say, outside of Donald Ritchie's the films of Akira Kurosawa, there aren't many of those books that you could really call in depth.
No, they were great fun in an era when it was hard to come up with stills from all those films and to get credits from all the films. It wasn't easy to come up with that.
Oh yeah, that was.
And so those books were valuable for their time. Yeah.
And it wasn't easy to see the films,
no.
Always. Some of them, yes. I mean, you had your Warner Brothers packages that ran on the local station, and your Paramount packages that ran late at night here in L.A., and you could see a fair number of things, but if it even veered slightly toward obscure, it was almost impossible to see some of these things, and that's where the value of these books, I think, really paid off, is that it gave you a glimpse of the rest of the career that wasn't easy to see. And I mean, I remember some of the travel alone I did in order to see some of Garfield's films. I would collect TV guides from various portions of the state, and if I saw a Garfield movie was playing in some town 200 miles away, I'd drive there and set up my TV in a gas station parking lot and watch it. And I saw most of his films in archives. And of course, nowadays you just wait 5 minutes on Turner Classic Movies and one of them will show up. So it's and finding stills now is, you know, pretty simple if you're not looking for originals. But I found a treasure trove about 90 miles from where I was living outside Oklahoma City when I was writing the book, a little town called Canton. And there was a place in Canton which was, you know, 200 people. But these guys who had once been theater owners had collected posters and stills, and you could go in there and buy a still from almost anything for 35 cents. And that's where I got most of my Garfield stills. There's about 200 or so in the book. And but, you know, everything's changed now. There's not quite the same need for books like that because you can go on IMDb and see all the credits and see the reviews, and it's not so hard to. I still like holding a book in my hand and thumbing through with an author's viewpoint as part of the package, and I would be delighted if they were still cranking out books like that. But
well, I have this theory that books today are kind of like movies were in 1953, that now it's time to start thinking of what can a book do that an e-book cannot do, or that a computer cannot do. Just like, let's make movies in CinemaScope or 3D. Let's do something that television can't do.
Yeah.
And I think books are going to go in that direction. It's going to be more and more specialized. You know, my next book, which speaking of 30 years, is the same subject that my first book, which came out in 1983, is. So, which means I'm going to die soon because I've gone full circle. So
maybe you've just gone around the first lap.
but you know, we're going to do that in a variety of ways. We're going to publish it ourselves. We're going to do one exactly like we want it to be, which will be gargantuan, full color pictures. It's already over 200,000 words, so it's huge.
Wow, yeah.
And hundreds of pictures and all that. But then we're going to do an ebook with no pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to do a print-on-demand with, 40 pictures or something like that.
Yeah.
So that people can afford to read that. But the ones who really want to decide whether to buy this book or a new car can buy one of the dream copies.
Yeah. That's a very interesting idea.
Yeah.
I'd just been thinking this morning, as a matter of fact, I was looking online and I found a still of George Reeves that I hadn't seen before. And I thought, oh, this would go good in the book. And then I thought, no, I've got like 400 pictures of him. There's no room for it. But with today's technology, maybe there's room for a special edition with everything I could possibly find crammed into it.
Yeah. One of my guests on the commentary track just last week or a couple of weeks ago, expert on Lon Chaney.
Mm-hmm.
Now, luckily, he is employed in a lucrative profession, so his Lon Chaney work does not have to sustain him.
Right.
So we just made websites of it. So he's just thrown everything into the website, because he doesn't care whether the money comes or not.
Right.
But I made the wrong turn in life of trying to write for a living.
And yeah,
that was a mistake.
Well, I have to tell you, when I was waiting for the Garfield book to come out in my 20s, still deeply immersed in naivete, I was looking at royalties. I said, okay, the book sells for $17.95, which was pretty expensive back then. I said, I get a 10% royalty. That's $1.79, $1.80. Okay. And there was some book about King Kong that had come out around then and had done really well. And I remember reading the sales figures on that book, and I thought, okay, well, a Garfield book will probably sell something like that, because, And I thought, so I could be looking at hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars here. And at the end of the two-year run that the book was in print, I believe I had pulled in $1,100. That's before the considerably more than that I had spent researching the book was deducted.
Sure.
So I'm not sure I broke even on that baby.
There are many of my books that I would have killed to have gotten $1,100 for. Believe you me, many. Yeah, somebody should have told me earlier on, because it seemed like, because I'm a fast writer and I'm a prolific writer. So I did the math in my head and I thought, and I didn't do the way you did, which I didn't think any one book was going to sell a gazillion copies. What I thought was, I can write books.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I've written 20, 30, 40 books, the combined.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's all going to steamroll toward me. It's going to be a gradually growing wave of money that's going to come toward me. I didn't really reckon on the fact that none of them would have royalties of any kind.
So 200 times nothing is nothing.
It's still nothing.
Well, I completely forgot what I was going to say.
I just depressed you too much by... remembering your early...
What I was going to say is I may be one of the few people on Earth who went into acting because he couldn't make enough money doing what he really wanted to do.
Well, you did intend... You started out writing TV scripts, right? I mean, that was
well
the first paying gigs.
That was the first real paying gigs. It wasn't my intention. I started out wanting to be a film historian. I wanted to write film history. That's really what my goal in life was. And I had some sort of vague peripheral interest in acting. I mean, in the sense that it was kind of in the back of my head that that might be fun to do sometime. Then I went to college after I got out of the service, and this was the early 70s. There, other than L.A. and New York, there were no film history courses around, and I was going to school in Oklahoma, where I guarantee you there weren't any film history courses. And I wasn't sure what to do, so I signed up for theater classes. I thought, theater's kind of close. I can study theater history and get some insights and blah, blah, blah. And I ended up doing plays, and that's when I realized, oh, no, this is what I really want to do. So from then on, my primary goal was to be an actor, and but I wrote a lot of articles on film history, and I began writing plays as well in college. And one of my plays ended up being very successfully produced in LA, and that got me a big agent and got me a lot of work writing television. But I was making a very good living writing television, but what I wanted to do was act. And then the bottom fell out of the freelance television writing market in 88, and simultaneously I stumbled into my first big movie role. And
was there a big strike around that time?
Yeah, it was the 88 writer's strike, which fundamentally reshaped the TV writing business, and practically, not completely, but practically eliminated freelance writers from series television writing. They began to, my theory is that, you know, the strike ended in September, which is well into what should have been the TV season. And my theory is that the, producers and staff writers scrambled so quickly to get scripts together, and then suddenly realized they could do it, and they didn't need to hire out 6, 7, 8, 9 scripts a year to freelancers. They could do it themselves, and that's really what's happened since then. It's it really changed. So I was making an extremely comfortable living for the first time in my life. In the mid-late 80s, and then the strike happened in 88, and I never made another nickel as a TV writer. But, as I said, simultaneously, I stumbled into this this movie role, which turned into a real acting career, and financially I never missed a beat, but it could have been disaster. So that's how I, yeah, so I didn't start out writing television because I wanted to. I actually didn't entirely enjoy it. It's a lot of work. And I was never terribly interested in writing for a series that somebody else had created with somebody else's characters. And I was lucky because most of my television writing was for anthology shows. And so I got to write episodes of the revival of the Alfred Hitchcock show, where I could create the characters, and I could I didn't have to be pinned so entirely to somebody else's vision, and so that was a lot of fun, but it was a lot of work, and I was really happy when I got to start acting and eating from that rather than writing.
I think the first time I ever became aware of you as an actor was when I went to see Bad Girls, which I went to see not because of the actresses, although I think they're all lovely, but I went to see it because of where it was shot, which was Alamo Village,
right,
in Brackettville, Texas, which is a place that I virtually grew up with. I spent my 16th birthday there, in fact.
Wow.
For the listener, this is the set that John Wayne built for his movie The Alamo in 1959, and it just remained as a sometime movie location, and a kind of staggered on as a Western vacation spot for a long time.
When I was a kid, my very favorite movie of all time was Wayne's The Alamo, and I saw it dozens of times, and even now can practically recite it. It's no longer my favorite movie of all time, but it still holds a warm place in my heart. And when I moved out to California in 83, one of the things I made sure of doing was stopping in Brackettville to visit the set, which was still standing there. And so the first time I was there, Happy Shahan, the owner, showed me around and drove me around in Gwen Williams' old sedan, and so I got that kind of view of it. And then that would have been 83, and then 10 years later, I was back there on the same set shooting Bad Girls, which was a thrill beyond imagining for somebody who cared as much about the history of that set as I did.
I can imagine. Yeah, it was. They did a lot of disguising so that it wouldn't look like the Alamo. But for those of us who know the set, it's always very clear where everything is. And what always tickled me is there's one scene, because there's a fake corner of the church where Wayne had a cannon, and it's actually on the ground several hundred yards away from the set. And it tickled me that there's a scene in the movie where they're just camping behind this inexplicable corner of like two stone walls, and that they've just kind of found out in the desert somewhere. And I thought, wow, that's the only place you've ever see that, except in its insert shots in the Wayne film.
Yeah. That was a fun movie for me. First off, it was a Western. And I got to ride horses. And, you know, for a guy who didn't really start working as an actor until the late 80s, I've gotten to do a heck of a lot of Westerns.
One of the greatest ever made, Deadwood.
Well, when you consider the fact that for a long time everybody seemed to think the Western was dead, and there just weren't many, I've gotten to do way more than my share. I have a feeling that if I'd been around in the 60s, I'd have done a lot more, but I'm grateful for what I've gotten to do. And you know, there's something about riding your horse down a street that John Wayne and Richard Widmark rode their horses down. It's pretty cool.
Now let's talk about Wayne a little bit, because I still run across people who seem to think that he was okay in his way, but wasn't necessarily a very good actor. I contend he was a terrific actor. As a matter of fact, I contend he was one of the best actors in the movies.
I completely agree. I've been acting for 40 years now, and not just casually. I study it. I work at it. And from whatever perch that gives me, I still find Wayne to be sometimes an absolutely astonishingly good actor. I will say that he doesn't have the range of, say, a Dustin Hoffman or an Olivier, but within his range, I'm not sure there's anybody who does it better. And I always say, you know, you can think Wayne's a bad actor until you look at some of the other people who try to do the same thing. And you look at Chuck Norris and tell me, between him and John Wayne, who's the good actor? I mean, somebody asked me this recently, who I have stolen the most stuff from. And I'm sure they were expecting me to say, you know, Paul Scofield or something. But I've stolen more stuff from John Wayne than almost any actor. I mean, just stolen in the sense of, oh, I see how he does that. That, oh man, look how he made that point with his eyes. I'll remember that. It's not imitation per se. I've probably drawn more inspiration as an actor from Wayne than almost anybody else. Maybe Jimmy Cagney comes close. Not to say that my work is anything like either of theirs, but you look, you know, Olivier said that true genius consists of knowing who to steal from. I try to steal from the best, and I can, I've done pretty well stealing from good people.
I'll say.
Well, I sometimes think that Wayne made his own limits in a way, because
I think so.
He did create a kind of archetype of the sort of things that he played, especially by the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
He is not going to veer too far afield from a basic framework of man that he plays.
Yeah.
Now he can play a bitter, angry man like Ethan Edwards, or a better-tempered man like in Donovan's Reef, or, you know, there is range within that. But I think if you didn't know him, and I think if he was not a star but still that actor, I think he could have played anything. I think he could have played...
Well, Ralph Richardson...
Anything.
Said that he absolutely loved Wayne, that Wayne had a mysterious quality that he thought was invaluable. And Ralph Richardson said that he, or Rafe Richardson, as I keep getting corrected by my British compatriots, said that he would have loved to have seen Wayne do Falstaff. Well, I can't imagine the circumstances under which Wayne would have, but one of my regrets about Wayne's career, and I followed it very, very closely, is that he decided, I think maybe inaccurately, what his fans were willing to see him do. And he turned down things that I think might have been pretty extraordinary for him. Darker things. I would have loved to have seen him play a heavy in something. Not suggesting that he would have been great in the actual role. I don't know, he might have been. But say something like what Burt Lancaster did in 7 Days in May, it's a strong, authoritative figure, but he's on the wrong side. And I think Wayne could have done that sort of thing marvelously.
I think he could have, too.
He never would have.
No. And that is kind of a shame in a way, because I could see him in theater. I mean, all sorts of theatrical roles. I was thinking of him as Willie Loman one time, and I thought,
wow,
he could do it. He could have done it. But that is the price that comes with that kind of iconic fame, that you really can't go too far beyond it. People just won't accept it.
Yeah. It's kind of like when Steve McQueen did the Ibsen play, Enemy of the People. Now, granted, McQueen wasn't really up to the task. But, I mean, that at that time, that was the only film that had ever been made in English of that play. I thought it was a very worthy effort, but nobody wanted to see an overweight, bushy-bearded Steve McQueen. They wanted to see him, you know, driving a Mustang through San Francisco. Yeah. And I think that what's fun is when an actor is adventurous enough to every once in a while veer out of the comfort zone of both himself and his audience, and say, yeah, yeah, I do this thing over here, but hey, look at this. Okay, I'm back.
Yeah, sometimes I think that in that sense, that James Cagney was possibly the most versatile star of that kind of magnitude, mm-hmm. because we definitely think of Cagney as having a strong personality and sense of identity, and yet
you look at the roles.
Look at those roles, and everywhere. He's everything.
Yeah.
And always terrific, mm-hmm. always terrific. Mm-hmm. And so somehow he got away with it, and I'm not quite sure how, but he did.
Yeah.
Because certainly Bogart could never have done Yankee Doodle Dandy.
No.
Although he could have done Public Enemy, I guess. Or,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But it's
Humphrey
interesting.
Humphrey Bogart and Yankee Doodle Dandy. The mind boggles.
<It does. laughs> I don't think he could have done those flips off the side of the stage. But, yeah, Cagney is one of those guys. But the 30s and 40s seem to be a rich period for people with vivid personalities and vivid persona, I guess, for lack of a better term. And in some ways, you think that they would be more typecast because they're so easily caricatured. You could think Katharine Hepburn is this, Betty Davis is that. And yet, all were enormously resourceful and versatile actors.
Yeah. In Wayne's case, I think a lot of it, too, was personal choice. I think he liked the image that he created and didn't want to move away from it, not just for commercial reasons, but because he felt like it was him at his best, and that he stood for something, which I'm not sure there were a lot of other stars of his caliber who felt quite that way. I think he very well knew that he was in the process of becoming an icon and didn't want to disappoint anyone who believed in that icon. Whereas, you know, Cagney always just called himself a hoofer and did whatever came along as well as he could. He preferred being a song and dance man, but he knew that his own talents could support him in a wide variety of things.
And that face. The God-given part of it was just, he was born with that face.
Yeah.
There was nothing he could do about it.
Yeah.
I was writing an article for American Film Magazine on Kirk Douglas when he was getting his Life Achievement Award. Mm-hmm. This has probably been 20 years ago. And because he was in Europe, I had to do phoners with him. But I did a phoner every day for a week with, like, an hour-long conversation every day for a week with Kirk Douglas. Great fun. Because every day I would get up because of the time change. I would watch Kirk Douglas movies all day, and then, like, 5 o'clock, I'd say, oh, time to call Kirk, you know. But we were talking about Wayne because we got to the point of his career when the War Wagon came along. And he loved Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
He said, of course, they were on opposite sides of the political spectrum, but he loved him. And I've heard that from everybody I've
ever met. I have, too.
I know a lot of old commies, a lot of old blacklisted commies. They all talk the same way. He was great. He was perfect, you know. He was an honest guy.
Yeah.
And But Kirk Douglas said he got a call from Wayne after Lust for Life.
Mm-hmm.
And Wayne said, you shouldn't play parts like that. He said, the public doesn't want to see you be weak like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you should think more about being a stand-up guy for the public. You know?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think that was, it's a funny thing for Wayne to say, but it's also, I think that
it's
was
revealing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think he felt a certain responsibility to not only be a good actor, but to be to fulfill a certain role for the public.
Yeah.
And whereas. While I you know, have practically idolized him my whole life, I don't agree in I think actors. I think their job is to be other people, and there are lots and lots of roles that I've taken that I would never want to meet that character in real life. But
be the most fun of all.
Yeah, yeah.
To experience something that you would never naturally experience.
Yeah.
And you know, I helped Clayton Moore, the Lone Ranger, write his autobiography, and
a swell job you did
well,
too.
Thank you. And it was not easy because he is not a guy who was very forthcoming about mm-hmm. anything, but. What was always really puzzling to me is that he locked himself into that character and made a decision one day that he would never do anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And he took that part seriously. A lot of people thought that he might have been a little nuts. He wasn't at all. He was.
Yeah.
But he realized what power
mm-hmm.
that image had. He quit smoking because he didn't want ever
yeah.
to have a kid accidentally see him smoking a cigarette. He
mm-hmm.
he went the extra mile to be what people wanted him to be. And the irony was, and I tried to get him to talk about it, but he was the least introspective human I've ever met. He was a great guy, but he just did not consider his own life. At least he, you know, I never knew him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But he did talk one day, you know, we were talking about the Lone Ranger episodes in which he would play another part, like a prospector or something.
Right.
And he said, those are the greatest days. I always loved that when I got to be another character. And I said, well, after the Lone Ranger went out, you could have done that every day. And he said, no. I said, well, you could have, couldn't you? He said, no.
Yeah.
But, I guess he took what Wayne thought, but took it to
I've heard from a number of actors, either directly or in reading about them, that they felt like their audience doesn't want to see them in this or that or kind of role, and I've almost always thought when I hear something like that, well, wait a minute, I'm your audience, and I'd love to see. I'd love to see John Wayne as Ahab in Moby Dick. Might be terrible, but I'd love to see that.
Sure.
And I'd love to have seen. I'd love to have seen Clayton Moore turn around from the Lone Ranger and do the Frank Sinatra part in the sniper movie,
yes.
Suddenly. I mean, a lot of that is just fantasy notions, but I love to see actors do something I don't expect, and that's where an actor like Robert Mitchum. For example, or Kirk Douglas, or Burt Lancaster, they didn't have any problem being a really strong, heroic role model figure in one movie and turning around and being an utter bastard in the next. And
we'll take Night of the Hunter. I mean, what a part.
Yeah.
And it goes all over the place.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
And it's terrific, you know.
I
You remember you and I went that time to see those outtakes?
Yes.
That was one of the most remarkable evenings of my life.
That was terrific.
Yeah,
I remember very clearly seeing those. I was just talking to someone about them recently. I think they may have released them with the DVD.
Yeah, they are on the Blu-ray. Yeah,
and
I highly recommend it.
Yeah,
terrific stuff.
But
yeah, Mitchum could do whatever he wanted to, but I don't think he cared that much about what his public persona was.
Exactly. Exactly.
I think he looked at acting. We were in Spain. I always debate myself whether to swear on this podcast or not, but so warning, here comes something. When we were in Spain for the San Sebastian Film Festival, Mitchum was over there at the same time, and he was being interviewed by this big room full of foreign press, and somebody said the predictable question, "What is your favorite film?" And he said, "Midway." And everybody went, "What?" And so the reporter said, "Why Midway?" He said, "Because I only worked one fucking day."
Like, yeah.
So that was Mitchum, you know.
Yeah,
But,
yeah, I quote him all the time on a similar topic where the interviewer said, "What's the one thing you look for in a script when you're making up your mind whether to do a movie?" And he said, "Days off."
And yet, I mean, you know he's lying.
Yes.
You know he is.
Yeah.
But he just was like that. You know, we went up to interview him for the Wellman documentary, and he was just a curmudgeon. I mean, he was almost impossible to talk to. Until I mentioned Alfalfa Switzer, and suddenly he immediately brightened up, started telling stories about Alfalfa. He and Alfalfa apparently were kindred spirits, and both would do horrible practical jokes to each other. He said one time he was in the shower, and Alfalfa threw a porcupine into the shower when they were camping. And so he... But, you know, that brightened him right up, but... And then he would start telling stories about people.
Yeah.
And was a perfect mimic. I've always been a great admirer of a director named John Farrow, who is mostly forgotten now, except that he was the father of Mia Farrow and the husband of Maureen O'Sullivan. But now I know how he talked, because Mitchum worked with him, and he was telling a story about him. And he, having heard him do Hitchcock, having heard him do James Mason, he did all these perfect imitations.
Yeah. John Huston was.
Yeah, he could have been Rich Little if he had wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, he could have gone. His career could have gone in any many different ways. Before we get too far to the end here, I want to ask you about your two series. One, I've already said Deadwood is one of the greatest westerns ever made. Certainly. As a writer, it's one of the few TV shows that I watch that I think, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I would, if I watched an episode of, say, House, not that I would write the best episode there ever was, but I could write one.
Yeah.
I could write a good one, you know.
Yeah.
But not Deadwood. I watch those every time. And so tell me a little bit about that experience. I'm really interested.
Well, I'll start off by saying right after we shot the pilot to Deadwood, in a conversation it came up that I had written for television, and David Milch asked to see some of my writing, and thereafter he asked me if I wanted to write for the show, which was pretty flattering. But what I said to him was, "Oh, that sounds very interesting." But what I said to myself was, "Nope, I can't do that." Now, I'm a strong believer in refraining from saying I can't do something, because I find it self-fulfilling. But I thought, if I try this, I'm not going to do as well, and I'm going to lower myself in his estimation. And I don't want to do that. So, and the reason I didn't want to do that is because Deadwood is the single greatest experience in my acting career. I got an audition. I got the audition material. I read this monologue, which was ended up being my first monologue in the pilot. And I looked at it and said, this part is mine. I may not get it, but nobody is better suited for it than I am. Not because I'm so great, but because it fit me better than anything I had ever read. And I thought, I know this guy. And automatically the next thought was, you never get the things that you're perfect for. So I started the self-doubt bit there. But then I had worked for Walter Hill in a movie called Geronimo back in 92, 93. And Walter was directing the pilot of Deadwood. And I had worked for David Milch once before. Bizarrely, I had played Jesus Christ on NYPD Blue in a dream sequence.
Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't think David remembered me. I wasn't sure Walter remembered me. It had been a decade, and my part had just been one scene in Geronimo. So I came in, I did the audition, and I took away from that experience two strong memories. One was of seeing David Milch out of the corner of my eye, leaning further and further and further forward toward me as I worked my way through this monologue, and with this huge grin on his face, and almost pounding his knees in either enthusiasm or torment. And something that I came to realize was very unlike David. He's a very he's not given to outward exuberance of that sort. So I figured probably that's a real good sign. And the other memory I have is when I finished the monologue of having there being this silence for a moment, and then Walter Hill saying, well, I'm glad to see you remember everything I taught you. And I thought, I think I did okay. So it was a transformative experience being on that show. It changed the way I approach acting, partly out of necessity, because the only full script I ever saw in 3 years was the pilot. From then on, never saw another full script. We got pages, and we usually got them sometimes 9, 10 o'clock at night to shoot them at 7 the next morning. And sometimes we didn't get them then. Sometimes we got them at 7 o'clock the next morning. And sometimes we got them at 7 o'clock in the morning and started rehearsing and got it all nicely rehearsed, and then David would come in and rewrite the entire scene. And so when I say it changed my way of acting, a lot of actors feel incredibly uncomfortable if they don't have a given amount of time to work on their material. And I've seen actors say, I can't do this. I need a few days with the script. Well, I felt that way too. I was always incredibly uncomfortable if I had an audition, say, the same day I got the material. I said, no, I got to have some time to work on this. Well, what I realized was that, A, I could kind of throw myself in and trust my own instincts. And of course, when we were actually working, I also knew that I could just jump off the cliff and David wouldn't let me die. Because he was always going to be there to fix anything that wasn't working. And everybody on the show was dealing with the same issue of having had very, very short time with the words. It's changed the way I work. I don't feel a compulsion or a dread if I don't have my script a long time before the show. Sometimes I think now I get too stuck in my ways if I have the script too long. It's better to know the words and go do it, and let your instincts carry you than to spend a lot of time in your head thinking and planning. Because I learned on my very first big movie that Norman Jewison directed, I had the script for 2 months before I shot that, and my wife Cecily used to tell me she could hear me running lines in the shower, and that I needed to be careful. I was going to get stuck, and I was like, no. I know what I want to do here. And then I showed up on the set, and Norman Jewison said, no, don't do it that way. Do it this way. Do it 3 times faster. Do it. And I was almost stymied because I didn't know what to do. I was so set in what I had worked on for 2 months that it was hard to wrench myself out of that. Well, I never had that problem with David Milch. There was never 2 months or 2 weeks or even 2 days to work on material on that show. It was so rich of language. There were a few times I didn't know exactly what it was I was saying. It was so intricate. But David was always there to enlighten us. And
it not only rewards multiple viewings, it requires them in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I was on the show, and I watched the show with the captions on in order to better follow it. That's not a negative with this show. The dialogue is, as I say, intricate. It's sometimes rococo, but it's become almost a cliche to say that about Deadwood, that it's Shakespearean. But the fact is, in its essence, it really is. It's human speech lifted into a poetic realm that still retains its power as conversation and human speech. And that's a trick I don't know anybody else who can make. On top of everything else, it was such a joy. There were something like 25 regulars on that show, which is a huge cast. And there wasn't a bad apple in the bunch. And I've been on lots of shows where you couldn't say there wasn't a bad apple in the bunch. Sometimes it's all bad apples. We all got along. We all adored each other. And I'm still as close to members of that cast 6 years later as I am with any other people I've ever worked with, and probably more so, because we all felt like we were in this crucible where something magical was happening, and it wasn't happening exactly because of us, but it was happening through us. And I don't know any of us who doesn't feel richly rewarded for having been on that show and who doesn't miss it desperately.
Well, we miss it too. But you've worked with Oliphant again on Justified, which is another terrific show.
It is. To clarify, I actually haven't worked with Oliphant on that show. We're on the same show, but I've never had a scene with Tim so far. I had read for a role on it in the first season that I didn't get. Another Deadwood alum, W. Earl Brown, got the part I read for. But I hadn't seen the show. I had heard really great things about it. And then they asked me to do this part that was rather an atypical part for me, I thought, because I've kind of gotten a little bit typecast in playing fairly strong, gruff but lovable types, and this character at first seemed a little weaker, and I wasn't real sure whether I would enjoy the part all that much, but I knew I wanted to do the show, and then as it turned out, they brought me back the next season to expand on the character, and it's seems like it's turning into something really interesting. But I haven't gotten to work with Tim yet. I'd love to, because he's a sweet man, but he's also one of the funniest people I've ever met, which is not something that necessarily comes across on screen with him. Certainly in Deadwood, he was not very funny most of the time. Quite the opposite, but I know I'm coming back for this fourth season.
That's great.
And gonna start work in November or late October.
I remember I watched Supernatural for the first few episodes. Mm-hmm. And then, I think you told me, I think we must have done lunch or something, and you told me that you were going to be on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had stopped watching it by then, but I said, I'll watch when Jim is on. So I watched, and it looked to me like it was a one-shot thing.
It looked to me like it was a
one-shot. Yeah, and so I was wondering if that was the case, if they had brought you on to be in one show, and then it, for some reason...
Well, I had all kinds of ideas about how that transpired, and just recently, I think the Paley Center did a thing with the show a year or so ago, and one of the executive producers, Bob Singer, who's my character, who's the namesake of my character. Much to his chagrin, it wasn't his idea. he finally told me and told the audience that night how it had come about. There was another actress who had played a recurring role on the show as a sort of mentor to the two boys played by Jared Padalecki and Jensen Ackles. And she fulfilled this kind of advisor, mentor, resource spot for in their lives. And they were doing an episode with her, and she wasn't available. And they said, "Well, we gotta have somebody fill this spot. Why don't we go a different way and make it?" This was a black woman. Let's make him a white guy, and maybe we can make him kind of a redneck. And and when they came up with that idea, Bob Singer apparently said, "I know the guy," because Bob Singer and I had done a series in the early '90s called Reasonable Doubts, where I was a homicide cop partner of Mark Harmon, and it had been, 15 years since we'd worked together, but he remembered me from that, and they offered me the part. It was just to fill in this one episode while this other actress was gone, but something about the character caught, I think, the writer's imagination as well as the fans. And on that show, they pay a great deal of attention to the fans. They follow a lot of what the fans say online. And if the fans really like a character, they'll often expand that character. And that's really what happened. That one shot turned into 54 episodes so far, more than anybody else on the show except the two leads. So it's been good. It's been good. Don't know where it's going now, but...
It's probably been the most popular show that you've been on. I mean, it has a huge following.
Yeah, it's got a giant following. I think...
And rabid fans. I mean, these
rabid, yeah.
These are eager fans. They love the show.
I got on, when I first got onto Twitter, for the first few days I had like 5 or 6 followers, people that I, you know, friends and stuff. And then it suddenly started growing, and it grew exponentially. And I'm over 180,000 now. And the idea that 180,000 people want to know what this balding, middle-aged old coot has to say about what he had for breakfast is astonishing to me. But we've got a pretty decent-sized audience in the States, but apparently we have a huge audience outside the U.S., and I think that, more than anything, is powering the longevity of the show, because the show's now in its 8th season. I feel very confident it's going to go 10. The fans, for the most part, don't seem to be tiring of it. And I go... I've been around the world a couple of times doing personal appearances for it, and you know, people ask me if I object to the attention that I get from this show, and I always say, you know, 6 years ago, I've been doing this stuff for 35, 40 years, and up until 6 years ago, nobody cared, and now, I stumble bum my rickety frame on stage in one of these places, and it feels like what it must have felt like for Elvis. I get my balance by walking out the front door of the event onto the street and going to the local Denny's where nobody pays any attention whatsoever. So it ain't quite Elvis. But within that subset of humanity, I'm big, baby. And completely bewildered by it.
Yeah, it must be a pleasant turn of events, because you've done your career as basically what we might call a character actor. And so it's not like you were ever the name above the title,
yeah.
And then suddenly all of this this is great.
Yeah, it's been a great change. It came at a time in my life when some good changes were very welcome, and I was kind of astonished by it. My astonishment is tempered by the fact that I know that it's really just for this show and for this show's audience, and that it doesn't have a lot of crossover power. The interesting thing is that when I was doing Deadwood, nobody really in Omaha knew who I was, but everybody in Hollywood knew who I was. Every audition, every meeting I went into, it was, oh my God, it's Ellsworth. And now a lot of people in Omaha know who I am from Supernatural, but nobody in Hollywood knows. They say, what are you doing now? Well, I'm on a show, Supernatural. Oh, is that new? No, we're in our eighth season. Really? I've never heard of it. So I went from being an unknown across America to being an unknown across America who had a Hollywood water cooler show to being an unknown in Hollywood who might have trouble walking through a mall in Des Moines. So it's been a roller coaster, and I'm grateful for it, because like you said, like I said, it was a long time of just being one of those guys who went to work, and somebody might say, oh, I saw you in that CSI episode, or I saw you in that Third Rock episode. You were good. But nobody ever went, hey, you're that guy. And that's, you know, being that guy has its upside and its downside. And I think actually I'm pretty fortunate to be that guy only for a certain group of people. And I could still go to the grocery store and they ask to see three forms of ID with my credit card. So I don't call what I am famous, although I suppose in some definition of the term it might apply. There are times when I'd kind of like to turn it off and go be myself and not have somebody ask me about why I gave somebody an amulet in the second season. But for the most part, I revel in that stuff. And but I don't have to, like I say, I don't have to deal with it all the time. When I would, 25 years after Get Smart went off the air, my father-in-law, and by extension his family, had to deal with people coming up and interrupting his meals and taking off their shoes and saying, it's for you, and as if they were the first person to ever say that.
Yeah.
And there are great blessings that come with this sort of thing, but even with great blessings, eventually you get tired of somebody scratching your ear. So it's a balancing act. Some people handle it better than others. I think the people who have the greatest fame, the Tom Cruises and Brad Pitts of the world, I'd love to be able to just pick my projects and do them. That'd be great. But I don't think I'd trade for what comes with that, because I like pumping my own gas and being able to get out of the car and then get back into the car and leave without offending anybody because I didn't sign the 340th autograph. So I'm in a pretty good place mentally with all that, and I'm so grateful. I really am. It's pretty astonishing at my age to have found myself with fans, even if it's 10, much less, you know, 180,000 Twitter followers. What's that about?
That's not a bad. And of course, when you tweet that you're on the commentary track, now that.
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, that's gonna.
That's gonna cut it in half. Yeah. That's gonna cut your following in half.
There, you know.
Just like that.
Well, you know, I'm sure a postcard will pour in.
Well, sure, absolutely. Well, I would continue talking with you all day long if I could, but
well, you can for my money.
Well, let's not wear out my welcome here, and then we'll just make a solemn pledge that 6 months down the line or something, we'll just do it again.
Okay, that sounds.
I would
good.
Love to do that,
because I mean. We've had these conversations without microphones.
Yes.
Well,
not that you knew about anyway.
Yeah. Well, you and I have a long history of sitting and talking into the wee hours about movies and stuff. And maybe next time we can spend a little more on that and not so much on me.
Yeah.
Because we got me out of the way, I think,
pretty
well here.
There's plenty more of you to talk about. So, and we will do it someday. So, Jim Beaver, thank you very much for talking to me, and we'll see you next time.
I hope so. My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed my talk with Jim Beaver. I always enjoy talking to him. He is just a great guy. We can talk movies. We can talk about lots of things, and it's always fun. I want to recommend a book. We didn't really talk about it in this. It's such a big subject that it really deserves an interview of its own, and I felt like this was not really the venue for it. But he wrote a book a couple of years ago called Life's That Way, and it is a memoir of the sad time in his life when his wife, Cecily, was diagnosed with cancer, and then she eventually passed away. And during the whole process, he was trying to keep family and close friends abreast of what was happening, and so he would send out emails almost every night. Later decided that it would be worth combining all of these emails into a book, and it really is something special. It's very touching. It's honest. It's sad, but it's that's not the ultimate reaction that you will have, not sadness, but you will see that it's also about hope and about the pleasures of life, and it's really a special book, and I highly recommend it. I cannot recommend it more highly. It's called Life's That Way. You can go to my website, The Commentary Track, and there's an Amazon link for it, and I hope that you will avail yourself of that, because you will not regret having read this beautiful book. And Jim is such a good writer that I live in constant jealousy of him for how much better he is at it than I am. And he's had great success with the book, and I'm sure that's of secondary importance to him, but it proves just how beautiful and how universal this memoir is, and so I recommend that you get it and read it and treasure it. I've also put links to not everything he's ever done, because, geez Louise, who has the space? I need more bandwidth to list Amazon links for the DVDs and videos of everything that he's done, but I've tried to put in the top TV shows and movies and just any links that I can find so that you can learn more about Jim Beaver and see more of his excellent work, because his work is consistently excellent. He's just a terrific actor. So go to the website, thecommentarytrack.com, and there's all that stuff. There's also my books and videos, and indeed the books and videos of every guest I've ever had on. If you just go to their individual pages, you'll see the Amazon links, and if you order through my site, then I get a little bit of a kickback, and believe me, it's a tiny kickback. Last month, I earned enough of a kickback to pay for the Amazon link, because that's what Amazon charges me. So last month was a break-even month. So this month, I would love for it to be slightly more than break-even. If you want to order lots of things through the site, God bless you. That would really help me out. You can support me in a free way by just going to iTunes and giving me a good review, giving me a 5-star rating, and say nice things about the podcast, and that will help more people come to the podcast, and the more people listen, the more success we're going to have, and the longer we can keep this railroad train chugging down the track. So I do hope that you will do that as well. We will be back next week. I have a really cool guest who I will reveal next week. You can just wait, can't you? Come on. What, you got to know now? Are you putting down money on it? Are you going to cancel your plans? No, once the podcast is up, you can listen to it anytime. I hope that you will come back and listen to that one. And if you haven't listened to all the ones previously, go back and listen to them. So we'll see you next week. And don't worry, we'll fix it in post.